And I'm going to do that so that if things regarding your resolutions don't go as planned, you will at least have had a chance to experience the relief of knowing that that's normal. Okay, there you go. So to the degree that normal is determined by the average behavior of, you know, the participants in the survey, a British psychologist, a guy named Richard Wiseman, did this survey that he published in 2010, I think, that concluded that 88% of all resolutions end in failure. So once again, as we say in our house, science proves the obvious. But there's an interesting sort of subtext here. In our brains, in our actual brains, resolutions kind of end up in the category that brain scientists would talk about with words like willpower. And Jonah Lehrer, he's the editor of a Canadian-based science magazine called Seed, he described willpower in terms of brain science as, quote, an extremely limited mental resource. And that's because, among other things, the part of the brain that's responsible for what we call willpower, which is the prefrontal cortex, which is just behind your forehead, is already overtaxed. The prefrontal cortex is responsible for a lot. If you start reading about brain science in any category, you just end up there way too often, which is part of the problem, because among other things, our prefrontal cortex is responsible for short-term memory, solving abstract problems, and keeping us focused. And so if we add the extra burden of willpower, poof, it just kind of, you know, there's this little smoke comes out of our ears and it just shuts down, right? And we have no willpower and we wonder why, and maybe it's just because we overloaded the circuit. So there you go. Given that in my life experience, my prefrontal cortex, when I read that list, when I was kind of researching this, I read that list and I went, well, that's how come I always feel like I'm teetering on the brink of, you know, like just shutting down. Look at all that stuff that little part of my brain has to do. So I'm not going to burden it with resolutions. You can make your own choice, but that's where I'm going. That said, though, I would have to confess, if I was staying in a personal space, that I'm not beginning the new year necessarily feeling all that satisfied with the status quo in my life. Everything's not right. Everything's not well. Everything's not as I wish it would be or hope it would be. Some of those things feel like they're the sorts of things that should fall to willpower, you know? On my normal road into the city, I drive past an auto body shop that has a sign outside that says that they make accidents unhappen. And whenever that's ambitious. Whenever I see it, I always want to pull in. I want to do two things. I want to pull in and say, how big an accident? You know, what are you talking about? But the other thing that immediately comes to mind is C.S. Lewis's language when he talks about God unmaking what is not right with the world in due course. And that's really intriguing language to me. When I think about what I want, when I think about what humans want, I think one of the things we have in common is that we want to be part of unmaking what is not lovely and good and right. And we want to participate in that in ourselves, but also in the whole world around us. And one of the ways we do that is by resolution. One of the ways we do that is by picking on the particulars and saying, here is a way that I think maybe I could make some incremental progress on making something right that's not right, or making something better that's not well. And so I think that's why we do it. And I don't want to suggest by where I'm going in the balance of our time here that there's no value in resolve or in resolutions. Obviously, without bringing some willpower to bear on the things that need to change, not much is going to happen. But if we bomb along through life sort of feeling like we're not participating, then we end up in one of kind of two categories. We end up in this category where when things happen that are good, we're just sort of a happy participant. And when things go poorly, we're an unhappy participant or victim. But in the end, we're not actually actors unless we bring something to bear on this. But in a world where there's so much for our brains and our lives to attend to, that it feels like setting a couple of New Year's resolutions might cause the front of our forehead to explode, or you know, something bad's going to happen, what might get us, you know, off our butts to attend to some of what we need to attend to? I think it's easy to be cynical about making resolutions, right? I mean, the research is all there. We can just justify it and go, ah, forget it, that's a waste of time and space. And yet there are these things where we go, no, it's something needs to happen here. What I'm going to propose this morning is that there's a category of our life that tends to get kind of short shrift or, you know, bad press, that's actually really, really important when it comes to what would motivate us or move us from where we are toward something better. And I think we could use words for this part of our life like dream or vision. Basically, it's a linguistic attempt to describe the part of us that imagines what might be or what could be, not what is. It's not the sort of realm that actually starts out behaviorally with how will we get there, which is kind of the shape more of resolutions, right? I will go to the gym 3 times a week is actually the answer to a question, how could I be less, you know, more, how could I deal with my unfitness, right? And it's incremental, and it's those are important kind of steps and all of that. But when I'm talking about this idea of vision or dreams, I'm actually talking about something that will get to that level, but it doesn't start there. It's sort of a 30,000-foot view of this dilemma. We start changing with wishes, hopes, and dreams. And just curious, a little word association game. If I say the words wish and star, what comes to mind? Anybody? Which song? Yeah. Did anybody else have that experience? Yeah. How pervasive is this particular song? I thought that was a really obvious. Yeah, who had something else?
Disney.
Yeah, okay. That song, When You Wish Upon a Star, was written in 1940 for that year's production of Pinocchio, has had so much traction in our culture that it has become the Disney brand. And consciously, self-consciously become the Disney brand. It's an interesting song. I mean, originally sung by this Cliff Edwards, there's a little Freudian moment. Cliff Edwards, who was the voice of Jiminy Cricket in that production, and it's gone on to be sung by any number of people, and it's still the one that the little singers roll out when they want to knock the judges on American Idol over, right? I thought, given how quickly that came to my mind when I was thinking about wishing and about stars, which were these two ideas that I was working with this past week, and we'll kind of bring them together in a moment, I thought, I want to know what this song actually says. Because we can all kind of da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, like we can kind of get the hook, right? But who knows what this song actually, so I went and looked up the lyrics. So here's part of the lyric from When You Wish Upon a Star. This is really, there's more going on here than Disney knows. Okay. Listen to this. When a star is born, they possess a gift or two. One of them is this. They have the power to make a wish come true. When you wish upon a star, all together now, makes no difference who you are, anything your heart desires will come to you. If your heart is in your dream, no request is too extreme. When you wish upon a star, as dreamers do, fate is kind. She brings to those who love the sweet fulfillment of their secret longing. Like a bolt out of the blue, fate steps in and sees you through. When you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come to you. Wow. Didn't write down the writers' names, but I wonder if they ever sat bolt upright at 3 a.m. going, oh my God, I think I overpromised. Wow. Okay. When it comes time for us, but we have dreams, right? And that's one of the reasons the song is so resonant, is because we do have dreams and wishes and things that we long to see happen. What happens when it comes time for us to kind of put wheels on a dream, to act on the things that need acting on, to move from this space where we're just thinking about things or just dreaming about them, to something that has the shape of an actual quest in the direction of that dream, an actual movement in the direction of the thing that we recognize as a significant longing or vision of what might be or what could be? What happens when we're in that space? There are things, I think, that kind of guide us when we're in that. How do we get this moving? space. One of the things that guides us, of course, is whatever our picture of the possible future is, right? That's the dream. But another one of them, and it's really significant, another one of the things that guides us when we're trying to actually switch from dreaming to questing is our perception of what kind of world we're in. In this world that we live in, what is it that we believe in our deepest self actually makes the things that we are dreaming of either happen or not happen? I realize it's a very binary way to talk about this. And if you've been around for more than a week, you know that I find that way of thinking objectionable and trip on it every time I hit it. Listen to this. Just going to go back to the lyrics from When You Wish Upon a Star. And I want you to listen for who is responsible for bringing what we dream to pass. Because the song addresses itself directly to that. So listen again. If your heart is in your dream, no request is too extreme. When you wish upon a star, as dreamers do, fate is kind. She brings to those who love the sweet fulfillment of their secret longing. This is an interesting intersection, you guys. We're heading into the new year, and Disney Corp would suggest that if your heart is really in your dream, the way to get it to come true is to wish upon a star, because stars, if we were listening, are really just another name for fate, uppercase F, personified, someone. And she, fate, is essentially another way of accounting for the unaccountable or of involving forces that are beyond our control, or a deity, or a messiah, or a savior. This is all the same bundle. Who makes your dreams come true when you can't? Somebody bigger than you, somebody more powerful than you, something beyond you. Who is that? Well, if you wish upon a star, it's fate. She does it. And what unlocks the power of fate? Well, your heart. This has to really come from your heart. So what happens if something really, you really want something, you're really dreaming of it, you're longing for it, you believe it should come to be, and it doesn't in that equation? Who's to blame? Is it fate? No, fate's off the hook. We're on the hook. Because obviously it wasn't really either extreme enough or deep enough in your heart. Because if it was, what would happen? Fate would make it happen. What's happening in the human experience inside of that song, and I'm not trying to make the song carry too much freight. These are the lyrics. This is what's in it. But what happens inside the human experience is we encounter things, we're dreaming of things, and we encounter the resistance to those dreams or the impossibility of them, and we wonder, how could that come to be? And we start casting around for an answer to that question. It's one of the huge human endeavors. How could this thing that is so important and so intransigent move? How can it move toward what is better? Well, that doesn't appear to be within my control. And then we kind of have these divergent paths, right? So I can break it down into increments and make resolutions about the increments. I can kind of go to work in a really practical, measurable way. Not unimportant. I could give up and just sort of park my ass in despair somewhere, and I'm not saying this in disdain for those of us who struggle with despair as an ongoing theme in our lives. This is a real space, and it's not an easy one. But we can get stuck in there and go, there's nothing that's going to move these things, so why would I even try? And or we can kind of go, well, obviously I've got to look for a source of power that's bigger than the one that I've got access to directly in my day-by-day functioning as a human being, because I can't make this thing move no matter how hard I push on it. What might that thing be? When we're in that space, we're asking that question, what might that thing be? What might that linkage be? We are on a spiritual quest. When the songwriter writes, When You Wish Upon a Star, they are describing the space of spiritual quest. And they're answering the question, the human question, what is that other bigger thing, with the shape of the idea that they call in the song, fate. So, this is an enormous, there's all sorts of reasons that song has horsepower. It's a great melody, one of them. It's a really significant idea, is another one. If I stay in the Disney space, what I come away with is this idea that if I hook the wagon of my dreams to a star, fate will see to it that they will come true. And maybe it's easy for me to be dismissive of that as sort of vague, as kind of this floaty, ill-defined idea that my dreams will come true if I just wish upon a star, but the questions that are behind it will not go away as easily as I can dismiss the lyrics to a song. We're headed into a new year, and maybe as we head into that new year, we dare to dream, to wish, and to long, or to hope for certain things, to hope that they would come to be, or that they would at least move toward coming to be. But there's something inside of us that is reluctant, and I think it's reluctant because we wonder sometimes if there is anything that we can hope in or wish in, the way that the song suggests we could hope in or wish in a star or fatedness. And it might be a strange idea, but I think that there might be some wisdom about this question that we can find in the story that is traditionally considered in liturgical churches on this particular Sunday of the calendar year. This is the last Sunday, if you follow a liturgical calendar at all, this would be the last Sunday of Christmastide, of the 12 days of Christmas. Epiphany starts on Monday. So you can brace yourself for Epiphany on Monday. There you go. If you're wondering where Epiphany was hiding. And the story that is in the liturgical calendar for this date is the story of the Magi, the wise men, these ill-defined characters who come vaguely from the East. What are they? Zoroastrian astrologers, they're peripatetic Persian princes who are sitting around one day going, we got a lot of money, but we don't have a project. Like, what? Who are these guys? We don't really know, right? Most of what we know about the wise men is that they brought gifts that were three, and so perhaps there were three of them, and they came from the East. We don't know a lot, but tradition has kind of speculated in a lively way, and we do have the text of the story, and I think there's something in there that actually speaks to this. What do we do about the dilemma of which star we want to hitch the wagon of our hopes and dreams to? The story is only found in one place in the Gospels. It's in Matthew's Gospel, 2nd chapter, first 12 verses, and it starts out like this. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." Oh, man. Okay. One of the reasons I love this story, I can't seem to get away from it. I come back to it every year at this time, and I just find it endlessly fascinating, partly because it's so vague. But it's so intriguing. Who are these people, and what was it that they saw, and how did they follow that thing? Like, do you realize that just in the shape of that question, we are immediately talking about, at least as an extended metaphor, about what it's like to look for God. What do you see that says, God might be over there? Like, why is that any stranger than the idea of following a star for God knows how long across the desert? They're both weird projects. That's ridiculous. Like, who would ever do that to their life? I'm so glad you all came out this morning. Here we are, okay? This is what we're doing. But here's the thing. The way that, even in this vague, ill-defined narrative, there are some things about the way that whoever the wise guys are, the way that they go about this thing, that I think are instructive. And I think there's just something here for us to learn. All well there, Luke?
Yeah.
Okay. These folks, whoever they are, have a dream that they turn into a quest. And whatever else this story might be, it is a narrative of some people who don't just sit around thinking, I wonder, about something that they find mysterious and compelling. This is a group of people who get off their chair and get on with questing. They don't stay in the space of speculation. They move into the space of some sort of action. And I think that's interesting in itself. And at the risk of making something too prescriptive of this story, I'm going to suggest that if we're trying to decide which star we should hook the wagon of our dreams to, then the wise men have something to teach us. And the first thing that struck me about this story when I went back into it this year is that their quest is not solitary. There's no particular reason why we think there were three of them other than the three gifts. But the story has endured around the point that it's not one person and their retinue. There's more than one quester involved in this journey that these guys go on. And I'm not sure how you picture this, but when I think about this journey, what the mental picture that I have, and I've been in some of the regions of the world that these people probably would have traveled through, in my brain, this journey is kind of an extended wilderness expedition. It's a long camping trip. We don't exactly know how long, but when Herod got choked because these guys didn't come back and tell him where this new king was, and he ordered the children slaughtered, a story we considered last week, he ordered all the children under two killed, and that has suggested in history and tradition that these guys could have been traveling for a couple of years on this particular quest. However it happened, whoever they are, whatever the shape of this journey is, there's a group of people on this journey. I don't know if you've ever been on an extended camping trip or a wilderness exploration at all. I've had occasion to do that a number of times, and some of those trips have been relatively long, sort of a month or so, which compared to 2 years is not that long. But one of the memories that I have from some of those extended explorations is end-of-the-day memories. And some of them were pretty exploratory. Some of them were not that prescribed. And I can remember sitting around campfires at night with this group of people who had agreed to do this thing together, talking about tomorrow, talking about what we would do the next day. And lots of times, those conversations were conversations that kind of morphed into pondering the imponderables, you know? They started out talking about the map, what was going to be over the next ridge, what the snow conditions were, whatever we were dealing with. And they ended up being conversations about something totally different than that. They ended up being conversations about the big, deep stuff of life. And I don't think it's a crazy piece of speculation to imagine the Magi and company sitting around in the cold of the desert night going, is this still a good idea? We said it was a little crazy when we started out. We're a year in. And the damn star just keeps moving away from us. And tomorrow we're going to get up and do this again? Frank, was this your idea? somebody's got, should we keep doing this? Should we carry on with the quest or not? And if we do, why would we? And if we don't, why wouldn't we? And who's going to get us all up in the morning anyway? And back on the camels for another day of this. This is important in the shape of this story. And anybody who's ever been on a serious spiritual quest, anybody who's ever really said, I think I want to hook my wagon to the star that I'm calling God, to the star that I would call a Messiah or a Savior or a deity that actually engages with the stuff of life. Anybody who's ever messed with that kind of a quest knows there's a profound difference in what it's like to set out on that quest alone or to set out on that quest in the company of like-minded deviants, fellow crazies, people who also agreed, me too. I think this is worth it. And I am going to try again tomorrow, even though the star keeps receding at the moment. And it's not a very convincing thing that I hooked my wagon to right now. It's vaguely over there. And so tomorrow I suggest we try continuing in that direction, because that's what we have to work with. Or we could turn around and go home. What say you, people sitting around this fire with me? Shall we carry on with our quest? It's a different thing, isn't it? I don't know if you've ever had a chance to sit in the wilderness by a fire by yourself as the night settles in. That's a different experience as well. You do think about tomorrow different when you think about it by yourself than when you think about it in the company of others. You do think about the dangers differently. You think about the challenges differently. You think about the goals differently. It's a different space. And it's a harder space. It's one of the reasons I have unique admiration for people who take on the extreme alone. That's why so few people do it. These guys, whatever else is true about this story, they're not doing this by themselves. They're doing it in the company of others. And I think that's a tremendously important and informative piece when it comes to the question of how would we pursue a dream that includes the possibility of the involvement of a being other than us. Loneliness, we know, we hear it all the time, loneliness is epidemic in our culture, and it's not just epidemic in ways that are sort of idea-based, but it's actually statistically epidemic in ways that are starting to show up in our health as human beings. We're not made to do this alone. We're not made to do any part of this alone. Even molecularly, if you were around in the fall at all and we were poking about in the world of quantum, even molecularly, we are connected. We are not just of an isolated individual piece ever in the subatomic world. And I think that's illustrative of the fact that we're not meant to be that way in the relational world either, and we're not meant to be that way in the world of spiritual quest either. I met Nicola this morning. Nicola was here when I got here. She was outside waiting for the bus. The bus doesn't come that often on Sunday morning. And I thought she was working at first, because we're not that far from Hooker Alley. And so I drove past into the parking lot. She followed the van around the corner. And I kind of waved her off, because, I mean, people who work on the street get this, and she would have understood. I'm not actually trolling. If you're working, I'm not shopping, and that would have been that for our interaction. But then when I came back around to open up the door, she was kind of back standing in front, and you know, there was something about what was going on there that said, this is not somebody who's at work. And so I came in, and I opened up, and I just stood inside the door for a while just to see what was going on as some cars went by, and she wasn't, as far as I could tell, she wasn't involved in the trade. She was just standing there, and she was obviously really, really cold. So I opened the door, and I said, you know, what you doing? She said, oh, I'm waiting for my bus. I'm freezing my ass off. I'm like, yeah, no kidding. You should come in here. So I just invited her in, and we stood by the door for a while, and she told me a bit of her story, which I'm not going to take the time to unpack now. The bus was a while coming, and Nicola and I had quite a chat. But I will sum it up by saying that just about anything you could imagine that a human being might struggle with in terms of issues with addiction, relationship, or part of her plate, and mental health, and layers of abuse in her narrative, in her story. What a tale. One of the things that caught my eye as soon as I was close enough to think of her not as a category of behavior, but as a person, was that her mascara was streaked down to her chin on both sides and frozen solid. She'd been doing lots of weeping this morning. She just lives a few blocks from here. Nicola might show up. I hope she does. I don't know if she will. It'd be awesome if she did. I have a chat with somebody like that, and I think, you know, I can live in a spiritual quest out of my head way too much. And I know that about myself. And so that's part of my challenge, is to go, what does the shape of action look like for these ideas that are so intriguing to me and so challenging to me? Have a chat with somebody like Nicola and realize there are things that even environmentally in that moment, there's only so much I can do, and I want to do that. I want to do more. What does it look like to change the dream of a world in which, if nothing else, more people would be able to say what Nicola said before she dashed out the door when her bus finally came? That's kind of weird, you know, but it's been really good to talk about all of this. Of course it is. Come on. Of course it is. We're not made to not talk about this. Everything we talked about was shit, you guys. It was all bad news. I don't think there was one category of that conversation that felt like it was bright with hope. Except that, at the end, Nicola said, that's kind of weird, but it's sure been good to talk about this. All right. This is a microcosm. It's a moment, right? Who knows? This is not prescriptive. This is just what happened this morning at 9:50 at the bus stop. There was a little bit of a campfire and two humans, and we both went on a little different for having sat by that and talked for a few minutes.
I realized that when it comes to hooking our dreams to a star, that doesn't answer all the dilemmas or all the questions. But what it does say to me is that whatever shape that takes, whatever star I hook the wagon of my dreams to, one of the things that needs to be true about it is that it needs to draw humanity together around the light of hope. That's just essential. And it's part of the shape of the story. I'm going to wrap this up because there's lots more here to talk about, and we've been talking about lots of good things this morning, and that's even as a community, and that's part of how we spend our time here, and that's all good. But I want to touch on just two other things quickly and briefly. Although it might be tough to figure out in advance, when we're on a spiritual quest, there are two clues about whether we've hooked our wagon to a worthy star or not that I think are worth watching for and kind of testing for. And one of those is that the star that the Magi follow leads them toward an encounter with God, a God, that is worthy of worship. I don't think the Magi set out looking for what we would think of in spiritual terms as a Messiah. There's nothing in the story that suggests that. They're looking for a king. And when they get to Jerusalem, they go visit Herod because he ought to know. This is a political story in many ways. This is a government story. This is a story about power and some of those kind of things as well. But when they finally encounter Jesus, their response is that they fall down and worship, Matthew says. That's interesting, isn't it? I can't help but imagine that they found not only different than they were looking for, but more than they were looking for. And I think that's a pretty important aspect of a spiritual quest. If we're wondering about the nature of the God that we are inviting to engage in the world together with us and us with them, I think this is one of the things to watch for. Does this being that our quest moves us toward stir in us that sense that this is someone that is worthy of worship? And another thing about the Magi's quest that I think is worth mentioning this morning is that the quest itself changes the way that they travel. It changes their path. I don't think we can encounter a worthy star, a worthy God, without it adjusting the way we walk through life. And whatever that adjustment looks like, I don't know, different in different moments, right? Let's do this. Let's consider doing this as a community. Let's consider what it would look like to bundle up our hopes and our dreams and our wishes, the sorts of things that kind of call us forward, the kinds of things that make us go, this is not done. This needs to be done. There needs to be some action here. Let's bundle those things up, and in the company of others, let's continue our quest for a trustworthy star to follow. The kind of star that leads us toward a being that is worthy of worship. And even if our journey takes us through the dark, and this is a curious thing about stars, you know, is that they're just as bright in the daytime as they are at night, but it's at night that we see them. They don't just shine at night. They shine all the time. And traveling through the dark, of course, among other things, can be difficult and disorienting and really challenging. It can also be the kind of season in our lives where the points of light that there are become singular and very, very significant. They actually are able to direct us because we can see them with clarity in the dark in a way that we can't in the light. And that's not unimportant. And so if we're going to gather things together and we're going to journey together, some of that journeying is going to be in the dark. And we're going to need one another's help to even notice the points of light, never mind to move toward them. But I think that's a worthy quest. And I think as long as the table exists under the mission it exists under now, our job in one shape or another is to continue to make room for that kind of questing, that kind of exploration, that kind of seeking. And not just to make room for it, but to be willing to do it together with other people. Not because we know exactly what we'll find, not because we'll necessarily find what we thought we were looking for, like the Magi, but because we continue to hope and believe that at the end of this quest, as vague and ill-defined as it sometimes might be, we will encounter a being that is worthy of worship. And then we'll have to decide what to do about that.